well, and ask that you would pray on her behalf. She's got some things to decide this year, and she's heavily considering moving up this way and being with us, but she's got a lot of things to get through and to decide before that happens, so just pray for her regarding that. We'd appreciate that. And I appreciate Clark taking the class last Wednesday. Hopefully we'll finish tonight in 1 Peter. And if you want to go ahead and turn there, we're in 1 Peter chapter 5. He said you all got about verse 7. So what we're going to do is just, we'll start here in verse 6 and just work our way here to the end with the time that we have left. So just as a recap, he started out chapter 5 by speaking about what particular relationship. Elders in the flock, and he specifically speaks to them here at the beginning of chapter 5, the elders, and that's because at the end of chapter 4, he says that the judgment is going to begin at the household of God, and we notice that in the Old Testament, whenever God and the prophets talk about that kind of language, that he usually begins with those closest to the service of God at the tabernacle, or those closest to his presence. So either it would be those, the Levites, or it would be the elders of the people, something like that. So that's what he does here. He kind of mimics the prophets. And so he says, I'm going to start here with the elders. And why might that be important? Why would you start with the elders? Okay, yeah, so he says that they exercise oversight, right? So they are the ones, they're guarding our souls, helping lead us towards God, towards heaven. So, there's a big responsibility on their part to do what they need to do to help us get to our objective, to our goal. And all of that is to be done in what kind of attitude and what kind of character? Humility, that's right. Humility and service. He says, he talks about that here in verse 2, verse 3, and then in verse 4, the reason they're to behave this way is because of who? Who's over them? The chief shepherd, that's right. And so this chief shepherd is going to appear. You will receive the unfading crown of glory. Likewise, you who are younger. So he says, you are to be subject to the elder. So he kind of starts with the leaders or the elders, and then he moves into the flock, and particularly those who are younger. And he says, clothe yourselves as well with all humility. None of us can get past this quality or this characteristic. All of us are to clothe ourselves with humility. And the reasoning for that is because God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. And you might have a couple different references there, Proverbs 3:34 and James 4 and verse 6. Are both passages that in which this phrase is used and referenced. So he continues that thought then on humility in verse 6 by talking about being humble. And he says, humble yourselves therefore under the mighty hand of God. So if you were to do a concordance search for the mighty hand of God, you're probably going to come up with a bunch of different references, but can you think of a specific event in which the mighty hand of God was very significant and handy? No pun intended. No, that's not what I'm thinking of. All right, the parting of the Red Sea. So the book of Exodus, that terminology is used a lot in that book, and specifically in regards to God taking Israel out of a place in which they were aliens and bringing them into the promised land. He uses his mighty hand and outstretched arm to do that. So that is something that, you know, brings up a lot of Old Testament imagery. So if you were to look at, I think it's, let me make sure of this here. Yeah, like in Deuteronomy chapter 5. Yeah, Deuteronomy 5, verse 15. He says, you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. All right, so he's just kind of reminiscing about what God actually did to redeem and to save them. And he used his arm, he used his hand to do it. And so Peter's really doing this very same thing. He's kind of going back to that idea. So if you think about how this fits in the context of 1 Peter, how does Israel's story and the story of these people here in the book of 1 Peter go hand in hand? With what Peter says here about the mighty hand of God.
It's talking about sufferings they're going to have to deal with.
Okay.
Okay,
so yeah, they were in a state of alienation in which they were suffering at the hands of the Egyptians, and I think it's the very same point. There came a point in which there was a time for them to trust God, and he finally intervened and saved them in a very powerful and dramatic way. And so it ties in perfectly then here to 1 Peter 5 when Peter says, humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so at the proper time, he may exalt you. It's the very same thing he's doing here that he did hundreds of years ago, and that is that we are to humble ourselves just knowing the fact that God delivered Israel from Egyptian oppression, and that's why you also are suffering. God isn't going to just leave you in this state either. Did he leave Israel in that state of suffering? No. And if he didn't do it for his people then, he's not going to do it for you now. He's not going to leave you here to suffer for the rest of your lives. At some point, he's going to come back, and he's going to deliver you just like he did Israel. And he's going to do it in a very powerful and dramatic way. But what Peter says is, in the meantime, until that takes place, your responsibility is to be humble this whole time while you're going through this. You humble yourself knowing that you're under God. And a sign of your humility is letting God work things out in his own time. When we think about letting God work things out, our focus goes to trust. Our focus goes to being patient. But there is also a very real sense in which there's humility involved here too. Because what do we tend to want to do if things aren't getting done? We want to help, or we think we can do it our way. Right? And then we've lost our humility. So this is the biggest thing, this hardest thing, I think, when you're going through a time of suffering, is to realize, okay, I want to just take control of this. But I need to know that I don't have the power to do that. Only God does. And so it takes great humility to let God just take over. And I think that's his idea here.
If you read through Psalms, in David's, his sufferings, trials that he was going through, he said, he keeps saying, I'll wait upon the Lord, I'll wait upon the Lord,
mm-hmm.
I'll wait.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that's great. So how does he say to handle this? Yes, cast your anxieties on the Lord. So, when you think about casting all your anxieties upon him because he cares for you, that connects this back up to verse 5, right? What does God give to the humble? He gives grace. And so now we kind of see what that looks like here in verse 6, casting our cares on him. And of course, we won't go to it, but Psalm 55, verse 22, Dutch just mentioned the Psalms, but David seems to be very in tune with his suffering and understanding that it doesn't matter what he tries to do, the suffering is not going to go away because he just wants it to. This is all a part of his giving it to God and letting God take over. So, yeah, we cast all of our anxieties on him. And Jesus did that, right? I mean, he gave the sufferings that he was going through, he cast them on his Father. He went to him in prayer and said, you know, I want this taken care of, but it's your will. You know what's best here. You do what you know is best. And that was Jesus being humble and trusting that God would take care of him in the midst of his suffering too. And if he can do it, he is the ultimate example of showing us that we can do it too. And so then he says, be sober-minded. Why put that there? What do you think?
I'm going to talk about the Satan here in just a minute, so be alert.
Okay.
Aware of what's your adversary, because he's out there waiting.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's right. Yes.
Well, Jesus tells his servants, you don't know the day or the hour of the master's coming. And be diligent, be watchful. Some are not going to be, and some are, and he'll come at a time that if you're not doing right, then there'll be no time to reverse that. So it's just a daily thing. I mean, just walk, be sober-minded means clear thinking, always under the influence of Christ. Seeking the best for him and for others. If you do that, then you won't be, the devil will have less chance of coming up on you suddenly and be overpowered.
That's right. Yeah, so he's mentioned this already in chapter 1, verse 13. Prepare your minds for action and be sober-minded, and then set your hope fully on the grace. So preparing our minds is obviously, it gets said, is a daily thing you have to deal with. And do. Chapter 4 and verse 7, the end of all things is at hand. And this is one of the things that also gets referenced Jesus talking about. We don't know the day or the hour he's going to come back. And what a scary thought for him to be coming back when you're not at your peak in your thoughts. And so he talks about being self-controlled and sober-minded for the sake of your prayers. And so the opposite of being sober-minded would be drunkenness. And so he wants us to be clear-minded. He wants us to be able to think straight. If you can think straight, then you can be able to make the right choice that you need to make. We recently started, started looking at some of the what they call the cardinal virtues, and the first one's prudence. And I did this with Jackson a while back. I just put this circle in the middle of this paper with prudence on it, and then I drew all these different roads, and only one of them led to God, and all the others led to where Satan wanted him to go. And so I chose these different actions for him, and he had to choose with each of these actions, which road do you take for this action, and where is it going to lead you? And that's kind of what he's talking about here. We have to have a clear mind to be able to think so that we can choose the right road. There's only one road that gets us to God. And if you're not thinking straight, we all know how a drunk driver is on the road, right? It swerves all over the place. Certainly you're going to hit a tree. So, we're at the time in which we're just waiting on him to come back. So we need to be sober-minded. And he says we also need to be, wow, I've gotten way. We need to be watchful. We need to be alert. So why would Peter, what's significant about Peter saying we need to be watchful and alert?
He was in the garden with Jesus when Jesus was praying there in Gethsemane. He kept falling asleep. But keep thinking of,
that's know, right.
The Lord kept coming back and saying, could you just not stay awake? You know, but and we need to be sure that we don't fall asleep, so to speak. We have to
That's exactly right. So, yeah, you think about that scenario in the Garden of Gethsemane when Jesus is going to go off to pray and he tells them, including Peter, I want you to pray. And the reason I want you to pray is I want you to be to watch, to be on the alert. That word that Jesus uses there to tell Peter and the rest of them to do that is the same word Peter uses here. And so why did he tell them that? What did he say? What did he say about the Spirit?
Spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak.
That's right. The Spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. And so that's why Jesus told them there to be on the alert and watch and to pray. And so Peter gives the same reason as Jesus, right? There's a danger, there's a temptation that's lurking behind every corner. And so Peter here gives the danger a very concrete form, specifically because it is the devil, right? The devil prowls about. And it says he's prowling about like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. This is the only time that Peter specifically mentions the devil in this book, in his writings here. He says he prowls about like this roaring lion. So how did Peter describe here in this chapter the Christians? Yeah, the sheep. He talks about them as a flock. And they're under the leadership of elders, right, in verse 2. So we can kind of just put all this together, right? This roaring lion is prowling about on a specific prey, the flock of God. And so we can make maybe a specific point about this here. Elders have been given a specific task of being overseers because there is somebody out there hunting us down. However, what Peter seems also to be telling us is that we all have the responsibility to each other to watch out for each other, because this devil, this lion, does he just roar out there and go get everybody? No, they're going to scatter, right, if you do that. He's somebody that's going to sneak up behind you, be as quiet as they can be. So we have to have each other's backs, especially now because God's coming at any moment and Satan is going to try even harder. He's already lost the big battle. Jesus rose from the dead. So now you think he's just going to give up and say, well, you know what, I've already lost the big one. There's no sense trying anymore. No, he's going to work even harder. So we have to have each other's back, and we especially need leaders to watch over us and help us with that.
You know, those lions, when they're on the prowl like that, they try to get the ones that are maybe not right with the flock, that maybe wandered over a little bit. And, you know, those things that can happen when we don't go to services, when we don't read our Bible and stuff, when we're not as strong, you know, that's when he sees his opportunity to pounce. And just like, I don't know if you ever watch the National Geographic and all that, watch those, you know, you see the gazelle and all that, and then you hear the... see the big lion, and you're like, oh, he's going to, and sooner he gets away from everybody, and he's off by himself just doing his own thing, and that's when he gets, and it's the same way with us. We've got to stay together, stay united, and stay focused, and it helps keep us from being separated from the flock and being easy prey.
Yep, that's exactly right.
Doug and I have a little ESPN there.
Okay.
Made in Christ, the ones that are a little weaker, and those are the easy ones.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And there may be a connection here because, you know, he talks about humility, he talks about the younger. And what is the big thing that Satan really got in the garden? What was the big thing he used? It was pride, wasn't it? He kind of manipulated Adam and Eve into thinking you're going to bow down to this guy when you can be God yourself. So humility, yeah, I think all that is very good. And in verse 9, he says, this is a third command he gives, and it goes along with the second one, But he says to resist him. And what does that imply, if you can resist? Okay. Okay, so if you can resist something, that means you can defeat, doesn't it? So it takes there's a lot of comfort in that. Yeah, you have this enemy that's like this roaring lion, but if you can resist him, that means he can be defeated. You're not going into a battle that's a lost cause. You can win the battle. And I think that's what resisting him implies here. You can win. And so because of that, you need to be firm in your faith. Be firm in your faith. And he's talked about that. That's what he started off this book with in chapter 1 and verse 5. Who by God's power being guarded through faith for salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. And so our faith is the victory that overcomes the world. We sing that song. And what he says here is that we aren't alone in this battle. And if we all will have the faith that we need and have each other's backs, let's just go out and let's defeat Satan together. Let's do it together so that he can't have a hold on us. And then he says, knowing that the same kind of sufferings are being experienced by your brotherhood and throughout the world. This brotherhood is what is said to have been that they were to love back in chapter 2. Verse 17, I believe, honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, and honor the emperor. And so he says, you know what? None of us are alone in this. There are brothers around the world who are going through the same things. The people I've told you to love from the very beginning of this book, they're going through suffering as well. And so we are all in this together. We all can resist. And if we will resist, we will all have a reward in doing that. And so he says, and after you have suffered a little while, if you look at verse 6, he says, therefore under the mighty hand of God, so at the proper time, we don't know when that's going to be, right? We don't know the time. That's only for the Father to know, Jesus says. But we do know that relative to our suffering, that we have a reward waiting for us. And that's why we fight. The God of all grace who has called you to his eternal glory in Christ, that's the reward that we have, this glory that can be obtained in Jesus Christ. And that's why suffering is just a little while. When you're in the midst of suffering, it seems like forever. But when you think about the glory that we're going to receive, and suffering is just temporary because the glory is eternal and it's forever. That's a pretty cool thought.
Whenever I would get hurt as a little boy, because you run to your mother, she would say, "It's going to feel better when it quits hurting." Obviously, it will feel better when it quits hurting. So this is kind of, we're going to suffer, but it's going to be better.
Mm-hmm. Afterwards. Yep, that's right. He's going to. It's temporary. It's temporary. All right, so he says, and after you have suffered a little while, Christ will himself restore, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. So restore or perfect. So do any of you like to buy houses and flip them? Well, if any of you like to do that, or you like to work on your own homes maybe and remodel things. I have friends that buy houses for a living and they just flip them. I like to do that, right? So I think that's the idea here, is that he is going to restore it, and he's not only going to restore it and make it better, he's going to restore it to its proper condition. And our proper condition is something that was in the garden before sin occurred. He's basically saying God's going to get you back to that place. It's just going to be great, except now it won't be taken away from you ever again. And so that is a pretty cool thought. He's going to restore us, going to confirm and strengthen and establish. He's going to root us and ground us to where Satan has no control at all over us anymore. Because right now, we're weak, we're faltering, we're struggling. In other words, we are working, we're striving, we're laboring in serving the Lord. It's difficult, it's hard, but Jesus promised that after a little while, this is going to be done with. And so verse 11, it's his doxology, to him be the dominion forever and ever. Amen. Anything up to verse 11?
Well, I just thought about the idea about his restoring, confirming, strengthening, and establishing you. Is that going to be on this earth or after this life is over?
So this is one of those things that's probably a already and not yet. In some ways, he has done that, and his resurrection is proof of that. But obviously, ultimately, that's not going to take place until he comes back. Because he talks in verse 10 about this eternal glory in Christ will himself restore. So he is talking about time in terms of eternity. And obviously that's, you know, here on earth, this is a temporary life. So probably ultimately he's referring to what is to come. But he doesn't restore completely yet. We are continually being restored until the final restoration takes place. So that's my half cent worth. What do y'all think?
Yeah, as long as we're in this life in a physical form, we're going to suffer, unfortunately, pain and problems, maybe not always spiritual problems, but physical.
Mm-hmm.
Is that somebody that's at the end of their life and they're sick and they can't get satisfaction, they can't get relief, they can't get any help because their body can't be repaired.
Right.
So they're still suffering, even though they may be healed or better, but their physical body is not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. I can't tell you how many times... before Dad died, he got through that cancer, but he was never the same. I mean, he was always talking about how his feet hurt so bad he could barely walk on them, and he was just ready to. There was part of him was just ready to be done. He said, "I'm ready to go home."
You know that in Acts, first chapter of Acts, they asked Jesus the question, "Will you at this time restore the kingdom of Israel?" And he replied, "It is not for you to know the times or seasons that the Father has fixed by his own authority." And I would say that would apply pretty much to this verse here.
Sure.
We don't know. It's up the Father in his time. It's not for you to know when this is going to happen. For those who think there's going to be a millennial reign and the Lord's going to return and there's going to be a 1,000-year reign on the earth, they'll say, "Well, this is when it's going to happen."
Mm-hmm.
That time, but when the Bible doesn't say anything about the Lord ever returning to the earth, it just implies to me that He'll restore the kingdom and He will keep all of these promises because it's fixed under His authority.
Right.
And I feel in many ways that the Christian has been restored from their life of sin. And we are strengthened, obviously, by the promises and the blessings of God. And if we want to be established on the truth, on Jesus. And so in a sense, I think that there's a partial idea there, maybe more than just a partial idea, that He is doing these things now. And then eventually the suffering and pain will pass and we will spend eternity with the Lord.
Right. Yeah, again, I think that's there is an already and a not yet to all of this. The, you know, Romans 8 talks about the new creation that's, you know, we're longing for the completion of all things. The earth's longing to be restored. So in that sense, He's talking about something that's going to happen when Jesus comes back, but there's also a real sense in which He has restored Israel in the coming of Jesus. You also have to keep in mind that the apostles were still learning at that point, and a lot of the Jews had in mind that the kingdom of Israel was restored when Jesus, when their king came, and that he would come and he would dominate Rome and be done. And that's not what God's plan was with that. But yeah, I think there's some of this has happened. A lot of it has happened, but then we don't even know the full effect of all this yet, which is a pretty cool thought.
He says, you know, standing firm in the faith. You know, you have to keep your faith. He says that your brothers throughout the world are undergoing the same kinds of sufferings.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to suffer multiple things. The God's going to get us, if we stay firm in the faith, God's going to get us through those things. And eventually, like, he'll restore us at those times. But the great restoration that we're looking forward to is getting back to where we're going to, where we once began before sin entered into
the world.
That's right. So I think this covers, I think I agree with what Gist is saying. I think it covers a lot of different things. But the big picture is that final restoration.
Right.
We're restored a little here and there through the trials and tribulations that we face and we endure and come through, we get that restoration.
Yeah, I mean, if I were to say that Peter is saying here everything's done and restored, would we all be happy with that? I wouldn't be. So yeah, I think I'm thankful Jesus has brought redemption and salvation. But I hope this isn't it. I hope there's a full restoration that's going to take place. All right, so verse 12, he says, "By Silvanus, a faithful brother, as I regard him, I have written briefly to you, exhorting and declaring that this is the true grace of God. Stand firm in it." So first of all, Silvanus is mentioned in Paul's letter a few times. There's a Latin form of this name, Silas, that's right, the shortened term is Silas. This would be most likely the Silas in Acts 15, that where Paul first meets him on that at the Jerusalem conference. And when does Silas become partners with Paul in his travels? That's right, after they have that that little bit of a disagreement about Mark, right? And so they have that dispute with John Mark, they part ways, Paul and Silas go one way, and Barnabas and Mark go the other. Mark was Barnabas's cousin. And then Silvanus is also mentioned in 1 and 2 Thessalonians. And probably this is the same Silas of Acts that Peter is talking about. And one of the things that they latch on to here is when it says it's by Silvanus. So by him could be that he was a secretary. Very common in the ancient world. We've talked about this at the beginning. That's what they called an amanuensis. And so that's probably something that he would have been referred to, similar to Tertius, who's mentioned in Romans. He also mentions declaring that this is the true grace of God. So this could be that he could be referring to the gospel message here. It could be talking about God's provision for them in the midst of their suffering. Suffering is the big key here in this book, so that may be what he's talking about in terms of the grace of God that he's also mentioned. And then he says, "She who is at Babylon, who is likewise chosen." So who's the she here? Who's Babylon? Yeah, so there's that's one possibility, is it could be a church. Some people taking this quite literally and said it's Peter's wife. I really don't see that here, but I guess somebody may have a pretty strong case for that somewhere. I haven't seen that. And but yeah, I think it's probably, when you think about somebody like, when you think about a Babylon, what do you think about? What comes to mind when you think about Babylon?
Empire.
Yeah, empire. It would have been the most powerful dominating force when Nebuchadnezzar was alive and reigning, right? And so what would be the dominating powerful force during this time period?
Rome would have been.
Yeah, Rome would have been. My guess is that that's probably what he's referring to here is a church that's in Rome. And so this is, there are a lot of books that would have been written during this time period. They use code names for different places. And a lot of the philosophers use Babylon as a code name for a reference to Rome. So that seems quite possible to me that that's probably what he's talking about. But the key point is that all of us are in Babylon, right? We're all in a Babylon right now. We're all longing for Jerusalem. We're all longing for the place where God exists and reigns on his throne. And I think that's the main point. They're chosen, and he says, we send you greetings, and so does Mark. We're going to, this year, go through the Gospel of Mark in the sermons that I'm going to present, and we'll talk about that more then. But a lot of people think Peter wrote the book of Mark. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that. And that Mark would have been somebody, a secretary of his, who was writing down the stuff that Peter had to say there. And so this is one of the passages that kind of show that they're connected at some level. Real quickly, when Peter was about to be killed, he was in prison, and the doors flung open, and Peter goes out, and where does he go? Yeah, he goes to this. Yeah, it goes to the house, and who's there to greet him? This servant. Yeah, the Rhoda servant girl, and she's the funny story where she kind of slams the door back and runs and leaves him outside. I hope it wasn't pouring down rain. But yeah, that was probably Mark's house, and so they were connected in some way. And then he says, "Greet one another with the kiss of love. Peace to all who are in Christ." And so in Paul's letters, he calls this a holy kiss, right? And so given the fact that these Christians are in distress, they're in a lot of duress, they're being slandered, it'd be nice to be greeted that way. With all the hatred that's out there and all the malignment they're going through, it'd be nice to receive a kiss, a holy kiss from your brethren. 1 Peter. We finished. Anything before we close? All right, so if you want to turn to number 85. Buried with Christ. In that first verse is what we talked about tonight. Buried with Christ, my blessed Redeemer, dead to the old life of folly and sin. And it says, Satan may call, the world may entreat me, there is no voice that answers within. And that's really what, you know, the book of Peter is all about. It's Satan calling out to them and trying to lead them away from Jesus Christ, the great shepherd. And Peter says, you gotta hang on, you gotta hold in there, because if you will, there's this great reward that is beyond anything you can ever imagine in this life. And if you're not a Christian, that is the thing that maybe that'll get you thinking, is this life is not all it's cracked up to be. There's a lot of suffering, there's a lot of pain. And if you don't have something to hold on to that's firm and give you firmness and a footing in life, then what are you living for? Live for something much greater, something that will restore everything completely and perfectly. And that's what we have to look forward to if you are in Christ. If you don't, you don't have that to look forward to. And so we want to encourage you to think about that tonight. If there's any way we can help you do that, we ask you to come now as we stand and sing.